extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here!
Oh, from New York, New York, you are listening to Extra Time. I'm Andrew Wiebe with my partner in soccer, Matt Doyle, is here. We've got a big Leagues Cup rewind for you. Match day one in the books. Doyle, what's up, man? This is not a trope. I haven't watched a single second of Leagues Cup. It hurts me deep inside, somewhere around the area where my heart resides. But I was at a family wedding. I've been dropped into the cauldron. Only you can help me. I know the score lines. I trolled Twitter occasionally, picked up a little bit from there, and I scanned Reddit. Can you help me? Are you ready?
I think I can help you. I think I'm ready. I did a lot of prep last week, as you didn't listen to. And that's fine. I'm not bitter at all. You had better things to do.
You're not family, man. What can I say? I got on a 6 a.m. flight out of beautiful Columbus, Ohio, where the All-Star Game festivities absolutely drained me, and went straight to Milwaukee, Wisconsin for a little lake life, for a little a vacation, as David Goss might say, but a family wedding, yes. And so many, many different social obligations were on the old schedule to be checked off. So I had two children under the age of seven. I didn't have an opportunity to listen to your wonderful podcast, but you've given me the cliff notes. I'll be doing it today because I'm in studio for basically the next week straight, absolutely locked into this thing. Let's see. Here's what I missed based on some basic math here. So I missed the first match day in totality. That's 15 games, 37 goals, 4 penalty shootouts. So by my count, MLS leads 5 wins, 1 loss, 2 draws to Liga MX, because I don't count PK wins in the official head-to-head. Like, in my mind, and tell me if I'm crazy, in a true head-to-head record, like, evaluation here, I just don't think you can throw those in, despite the fact that obviously they do give you an advantage, 2 points to 1.
Yeah, I mean, that's the FIFA standard, and I think that is that's how it will go down for Querétaro and Chivas, the two Liga MX teams that lost in penalty shootouts. Obviously, for Leagues Cup purposes, it is a loss that gets you 1 point in terms of FIFA records in competitive matches. It goes down as a draw for all the teams involved. And as you are Andrew Wiebe, who always abides by the highest authority in the game, you're a big FIFA guy.
I didn't see that coming. Turnabout is fair play here. Now, it's 7-1 for MLS if you don't abide by those particular regulations and that authority. So it's been a good start for MLS, but a bunch of big teams are coming in. Monterrey, Cruz Azul, Santos Laguna, Tigres on the MLS side, LA Galaxy, Cincinnati, Real Salt Lake, the Rapids, Toluca is going to come in this match day too as well. And we're going to see those teams depending on seeding hosts. And I just want to remind people before we get into the nitty gritty, and Doyle's going to try to guide me through it from kind of the overall vibe so far of the competition to the best thing that he saw to all the random MLS connections / dude of the match days that really tickle my fancy. I mean, we're talking like, you know, Francisco Calvo being back for Juarez, that sort of thing. Plus craziest game and much, much more. We'll hit transfers and BJ Callahan, et cetera, et cetera. My dreams of an hour show are officially dead. Yeah, I need to tell people seating matters. Like, clubs want to maximize home games. So where your team finished last year in MLS is determining now where your fate is decided in Leagues Cup, how many home games you get, how many gates those teams get, how that affects their budget in the future, where they can go in the round of 32 and beyond. I mean, this does matter. So think about it in that way. But before we get there, to all the nitty-gritty, do an overall vibe check. Where are we at? Fun, competitive, crazy, weird, please, all of the above?
Yeah, I think all of the above. It actually reminds me of last season when we were all a little bit skeptical of what the tournament was going to be and how seriously teams are going to take it. And then it came out of the gates real strong last season. And just like last season, we had the first round, none of the Liga MX giants played. And so we had to wait until round two. And by that point, the intensity level of the whole thing had sort of been established. And I think that's what we saw in this one as well. Granted, there was some squad rotation. You know, Tijuana, JCO, he played mostly the backups. We've seen a lot of backup goalkeepers. Nick Cushing really experimented with his lineup last night for New York City FC. So there's been it's been fun. I think more fun in a way because of that. And I'm into it. And I kind of expected it this year. Last year, I didn't think I would be as into it as I was right away. This year, I kind of expected to be juiced by the first weekend, and it didn't let me down. Like, we had some real freaking bangers in these first 15 games.
It's kind of reminds me, and we're still in the early days of this competition, of seeing how teams approach it, of just experiencing it game by game. How do group stages actually end up shaking out? You know, given we have three teams and the comp, you know, the way it's set up is a little different, the scheduling and how you allocate resources and where the games are played. How does this all sort of shake out? Like, it feels like interleague play to me back in the day with Major League Baseball, where it felt like a novelty to start. It was like, oh, we never get this. And it was quickly a reminder of why these two areas are so competitive, you know, US, Canada, and Mexico, and how that competition is going to launch or maybe detract from clubs and leagues in the future. Who has the upper hand matters. I mean, I still look at this and I just think, man, three CONCACAF Champions Cup spots. Mm. Like, that matters if you're an ambitious club. It matters to win stuff if you're an ambitious club. Like, there's no reason to play this game, to have these soccer teams, to put together professional leagues other than to win things. And I know, talking to GMs and players alike, like, they want to win. And also, there's a bunch of cash for the players too. Like, if you win games, you're going to make money. And I'm just, you know what? Who's going to get that hourglass, Doyle? Can we call it the hourglass? Is that allowed with the trophy? That's what it reminds me of.
I didn't know what you were referring to. Yeah, the hourglass. That's a good name for it.
No.
I picked Columbus, and based upon what we saw from Columbus against Aston Villa, I'm pretty confident in that one.
I'll split you and go Club America. I picked Columbus in the official MLSsoccer.com thing, but just, you know, to keep things even, so to speak, I'll take America. Let's jump into it. What's the best thing you saw?
Daniel coming back for San Jose, which I did not know was happening. And you recall, I think before the season, everybody picked Daniel to be goalkeeper of the year. And then he came out and he was rough the first couple of weeks. And it turns out he was rough because he had a bad hamstring and then injured it pretty badly. And we didn't even know if he was going to play again in 2024. And he definitely played again. I thought he was very good for San Jose, who got a PK shootout win over Chivas. This was one of the most fun, one of the most dramatic, one of the craziest games of that first round. And for a Quakes team who have been, I mean, deader than dead all year long, to get that scene and to get that outcome in front of 50,000, presumably mostly local fans, you couldn't have asked for a better shot in the arm to your fading season than what was presented on the night.
Yeah, but do you think that, like, San Jose fans, coaching staff, players, are, you think they're feeling those good vibes? Because one of the few things I did see, because I did instant replay, was the whole, I don't know, frustrating, petty, weird moment at the end with Rodriguez doing he tried to go down three or four times as Chivas just like closed the vise late in that game in second half stoppage time. And once Rodriguez finally went down, the referee was like, yeah, okay, get off the field. Then didn't let him on for the 50 seconds it took for Chivas to again fully close the vise and get the equalizing goal. Like, they were that close, Doyle. And did I see correctly or hear correctly or read on Twitter that Wando got a red card? Is that a real thing?
Yeah, Wando got a red card. Like, you made a good point in the pre-show about the way the official handled it. And you kind of thought he did an okay job with it. I thought the whole thing I thought it all seemed pretty petty, the way he handled it, and I think that's what Wando got the red card for, less in terms of refusing to let Rodriguez on, and more just in terms of his general demeanor as he was trying to handle this game. And I'm not a big talk about the refs guy. I think in general, the refs do a much better job than fans and producer Anders Aarhus thinks the refs do. This one, he seemed to be dumping kerosene on a smoldering fire that by the 75th minute was a blazing fire. And certainly down the stretch, the way he handled the last 10 minutes of the game, including stoppage time, borderline disaster to me.
Yeah, I hear you, man. Mario Escobar is the referee. I think it's disrespectful to talk about the job that he was doing, whether we agree or disagree with that, using his name. He's earned that. And I'm not saying that because of controversy.
I think that was his goal. That was his goal for people to be using his name.
And fair enough. Fair enough. Like, I didn't watch the whole game. We've clearly established that, but I watched the 5 or 6 minutes of action around that period. There was no yellow card for Rodriguez. It was, I think, for dissent, perhaps, to Morales. I don't know. There was a lot of yelling. Gureza was in there trying to calm him down. Certainly, Escobar was extremely demonstrative and not really in a, like, hey, everyone calm down sort of way. More in a, I'm super frustrated about the way this is all going. But in some ways, I can get that based on Rodriguez's behavior. Like, I get that he's cramping. I get that he's hurt. Like, I completely respect that if you're injured, you are injured. But with the ball in play and it not being a serious injury, the referee has no obligation to stop play while the ball is in play. So, or when it's out of play, to be honest with you. He doesn't have to say you have to stop. Rodriguez is jumping up and down for basically a minute, trying to go down, does go down, I think twice, at least one time before finally being sent off the field when the Quakes finally get a goal kick. And at that point, instead of receiving the treatment that he has so clearly indicated that he desperately needs, he immediately jumps up and attempts to run to the sideline and get himself back in. So in a lot of ways, I understand the referee saying, now hold on. You were so desperate to essentially time waste and stop play here that you tried to go down multiple times, but now you're trying to come right back on. And then Chivas is, again, as we said, I mean, they're just putting the pressure on. It's attacking into the Quakes final third over and over. There's not really a good moment to bring him on. By the way, the laws say that the referee can allow that player to come back on while the ball is in play as long as they are on the touchline, essentially at the Quakes bench where you would enter and exit the game officially, which Rodriguez got to. But by my count, it's like 50 seconds, 50-ish seconds after the ball goes into play, probably more like 40 seconds because Rodriguez has to get himself to the touchline, that he is not allowed to come and play. There is one moment when the Quakes clear the ball long that he may have allowed him to come back on. San Jose puts the ball under no pressure, and Chivas is immediately back into the final third and end up scoring the goal. That would be the one time I think that if you're the referee, you could say, look off and avert your concentration from this intense game at hand that's looking for an equalizer and say, come back on. He didn't do it. Maybe it was petty. Maybe it was, maybe he was frustrated with Rodriguez and his behavior. Maybe it was completely unfair. Certainly I understand why the Quakes would be so frustrated by it. I just don't happen to think it's some grave injustice. When you go down four times and immediately try to come back on the field as if you're okay again, you might be delayed. So, sounds crazy though. If that 5 or 6 minutes is any indication, well done to San Jose and well done to the 50,000 in attendance on that one. Can I throw out this one as best thing I saw? I read it. I didn't see it. Robert Taylor, contract extension through 2026. This is a guy that it seemed like they were trying to ship off, Doyle.
We were talking about it at the start of the year. Like, once he rejected that move to Saudi Arabia, we were like, okay, does he get traded to Houston? He would be perfect for Houston. And we were like trying to find MLS team
that would trade him
because he's really good. And finally, Miami, their decision makers all came to the conclusion, including, I would guess, Tata Martino.
I think had a voice. Tata, right? It's got to be Tata. Yeah.
Where it's like, okay, you know what? This guy actually is, if not necessarily first choice 11 when I have everybody, he's like our first attacking piece off the bench. And he's earned it. And I hope he, got a nice fat check out of that one. And he's a big part of why Miami looked like among the absolute favorites to win this thing again.
Just the fact that it seemed like he was clinging to the cliff. And like Miami were kind of kicking his fingertips, like, oh, don't fall. Like, oh, well, if we have to move on, we'll do it. He climbed back up and got a contract extension through 2026. He would not leave. He's like, I see Messi here, man. I'm not walking away from Inter Miami while I'm here. Other best thing I saw, and I did see the highlights of this again, Cucho hat trick versus Aston Villa. Take that, EPL. How long can the crew keep this guy, Doyle? Like, he is just magic. Right? Yeah. He's magic. And Taylor Twellman tweeted out, and so I brought it to the show here. What if the crew had an ironclad offer for $18 million? Let's just say it's the Premier League for Cucho. I don't know. Let's say he'd like to go, but he's not like beating the door down to say, I have to go or else we're going to have problems. Would you do it?
I would, in all of these instances, I would try to hold the player through the end of the season and then do it in January, because I think most players eventually want to go, in Cucho's case, go back to the Premier League or La Liga, or to a lesser extent, Serie A, Bundesliga. So if he wants that and is not sabotaging the team level wants it, but like clearly wants it, I think you do right by the player. And the thing is with Cucho, Colombia is really good and he's not getting into the team right now. And if he ends up in the right Premier League team or La Liga side, and he performs to the level that we all think he can perform at, then he's going to the World Cup in 2 years. And I think that would be a big deal for him. It obviously would be. So this is all the stuff that new GM Issa Tall is going to have to consider, because when a player performs at this level in MLS, it's going to attract notice. There are probably going to be offers, and the crew are probably going to have to make a tough decision, and it could end up being one of the first massive post Tim Bezpachenko decisions for this team. And that's presuming that there isn't an offer for Wilfried Nancy in the coming weeks, because he might be the best prospect on this team when it comes to European offers and European opportunities.
Yeah. This is best in class problems right here.
Yeah.
Right.
Like these are the problems you want to earn as an
exactly.
MLS team.
Exactly. And I think for Cucho, for crew fans, for the organization, anybody who likes watching this league and watches Cucho, losing him would be painful, but you're not going to lose him. Right. Like if you sell Cucho Hernandez for $18 million and he came to Major League Soccer after, you know, having some moments in the Premier League, but playing for a relegated team, and it wasn't like he was a star or anything like that. If you can flip that to double the money paid back to the EPL, full of confidence, with an opportunity to make the Colombian national team, with an opportunity to sort of prove a pathway for the crew, certainly for the league overall as well, of like, hey, are you a early 20s star whose career isn't exactly getting the traction that you want? Do you want to go be the man somewhere? Do you want to go have amazing experiences and make a bunch of money and travel around the United States and Canada and do some cool things and, you know, break into your national team? And maybe that's the next step, but earn the move back and then to a better place for more money and have another opportunity to succeed. Like, that seems like a pretty good example to set in the transfer market, especially in the area where MLS is competing right now. So it would be painful, but Isatal better have a long list of potential replacements, because $18 million can go a long way. And if you're the crew and you just did this with Cucho, let's get that scouting network fired up. Let's try to get that player in with Wilfred if you can, because it seems like Wilfred is the freaking Pied Piper of transfer value. I mean, think about Montreal, all those guys that made life-changing moves out of that team. Now, if it's Cucho, if it's Aiden Morris, is it Diego Rossi? Maybe down the line as well. Best in class, I think, is a pretty good way of putting what's going on in Columbus right now. We'll see them once the group stage ends. Here's some random MLS connections / due to the match day, just to, you know, wet your League's Cup palate before we get into some more. No Reynoso even in the squad for Tijuana is a crime, Doyle. I can come right out and say that.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, Efra Alvarez did get the start and Joe Corona came off the bench, and all of this was part of like a classic JCO Juan Carlos Osorio performance. Of course, the former Red Bull and Chicago manager. He rotated the squad. He changed both the team's formation and line of confrontation. He changed the team's shape and possession from a 3-2-2-3 to a 2-3-2-3. And they got absolutely drubbed by LAFC. I felt like I was watching the 2009 Red Bulls all over again. It was just uncanny. So the strongest random MLS connection in that game was the performance of JCO, because it took me back, man.
We wanted Reynoso, and Juan Carlos Osorio was like, I'm actually the main character here, guys.
Correct.
You forgot. You forgot. Cade Cal, by the way, on that Chivas loss, draw, you get it. One-pointer. He started. He missed a penalty kick. Fidel Barajas came off the bench. Chicharito not on the bench for Chichas. Jordi Alcevar siding. You remember him? I think he was one of the first signings for Charlotte. He started for León in a loss to the Portland Timbers last night. Querétaro doing their thing.
John de Cadiz in that one, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think he had the assist on León's goal. And he's been really good.
Yeah.
He's been really good for León to start this season. Former Nashville DP. Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Querétaro's been bad, and they have some MLSers or former MLSers. Ake Loba's there. Lucas Rodriguez, you might remember him from DC United fame. Ronald Cisneros as well, who had half a season for Atlanta, maybe?
Sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, missed the penalty for them, too. Lucas Cavallini didn't start for Puebla, but he is their top scorer. Miami dispatched them easily. Josue Colman and Luis Amaria both started for the Fighting Anders Aarhuses, a.k.a. Mazatlan. There's no bigger Mazatlan fan in the, Queens area than Anders. And then we're going to get a treat here. Juarez is about to enter the tournament. Francisco Calvo, Jairo Torres, Bofo Salcedo, and Jonathan Gonzalez, a part of that team. That's crazy. But what was the craziest game? Was it Atlanta, D.C.? I was watching the scores, Doyle, and that seemed like a pretty fitting start, if not the start, Liga MX MLS that I wanted.
Yeah, it was up there, man. Atlanta, D.C. was a lot of fun. I'm not sure how much it means in the long run, but the craziest game was Austin's win over Pumas, because Pumas have been red hot coming out of the gates in this Apertura, playing really well. Austin have not been great. They're a fringe playoff team, but it's like 2022. They're significantly overperforming their underlying numbers, but they're now integrating new pieces. One of them, Osman Barkhari, the Ghanaian winger, he gets an early red in this game. So Austin end up playing about the last 60 minutes down a man. And as they're holding on for dear life, because they had taken an early lead, Pumas is battering down the door, and somehow Austin get two goals, went down to 10 men. And I think Steph Cleveland saves a penalty, and Austin come away with a 3-2 win. It's literally one of the greatest wins in club history. I would put it behind their 2022 playoff wins and a couple of their regular season wins that year. But it was a great moment. And, Austin fans, as they do, come at, I think, both of us on social media. It's like, what are you going to talk about in terms of overperformance? It's like, yeah, this was a definitive overperformance and not sustainable. And that's fine. You should celebrate it anyway, but the team needs to play better. It needs to absolutely not go down a goal again, because you get like one win like this every 3 years. Like, this is not normal, and that's okay, because tournaments are supposed to be fun and they're supposed to have incredible moments like this. And that's exactly what it was for Austin.
Look, I thought the Bukhari red card was, I didn't think that first yellow, and again, I didn't, it's instant replay, so don't be like, oh, Weeby, you didn't watch it. The first yellow is crazy to me in the 27th minute, and it just sets up what then I don't think is a very just final decision with the two yellows and the red card by Julio Luna, the referee. Like, that first yellow is not particularly late. It's not particularly, like, the contact is not egregious in any way. It doesn't really look reckless to me. It just looks like a normal 27th minute, timing slightly wrong foul. If you give it a yellow card, now you've set yourself up to have to give this dude a red for a justified second yellow that you didn't need to have happen. Just feel like the game management on that one could have been a little bit better. But hey, look, welcome to CONCACAF Champions Cup. Welcome to Leagues Cup. Welcome to some of the insanity that happens in these competitions. That's just the way it goes. And Austin clearly, I guess, found a way to persevere. Now they'll have to persevere with Monterrey in town in match day 2. So TBD on that one. By the way, did you see the Alexei Moranchuk news from Atalanta that Atlanta United went through? And by went through, I mean Tom Bogert tweeted it.
Yeah, I did.
5 days ago. 13 million.
13 million. He has a pretty good history across both the Russian league and Serie A. He's got about 30, 35 caps for the Russian national team. He is a playmaker in his prime who fits all the bills of what Garth Lagerwey has historically looked for in DPs and what he said he was going to focus on. And 2 weeks ago, I think he went on the local radio program there and he said, we're not going to be using our DP slots on prospects anymore. We're using our DP slots to buy tent pole players who can lead this team to trophies. Moranchuk looks like all that. The one little thing I am worried about, some nerd friends of mine in one of my Discords, guys like, you know, John Mueller from The Athletic and Ben Wright from Nashville, a few others, have done some work on translating super sub numbers, attacking numbers, to full-time starter numbers. And there can be a drop-off, and it could be sharp. And there's already some proof of that in MLS from Atalanta when you look at Luis Muriel, who was a super sub for Atalanta, like Moranchuk has been. And he just has not translated all that well to what Orlando City are doing, to the point where he is now not even starting for Orlando City. So there is a little warning flag on Moranchuk, but I still think that this signing is more likely to succeed than to fail.
The good news for Atlanta, Doyle, is that they don't need a DP number nine anymore. Not with Daniel Rios going 10 goals plus assists in his last 11 matches. I mean, with that kind of production, why?
Right?
What's the point?
Right?
Leave the money in your pocket. It's not burning a hole. Not with Danny Rios handling business. Now, that's been a nice little story for Atlanta, but they still have some big holes to fill. We'll see if they can do it. How about best individual performances? Keep catching me up, man. This is super helpful. MLS Gone Wild gave a couple guys that have had some good form of late, and Daniel Rios was one of them. Romero Enrique was another, goals in five straight. While we're talking about Luis Muriel being a little bit of a bust so far, what'd you make of the big win for Orlando City? Is this Montreal at home, or is this a continuation of Orlando finding their way?
It's a continuation of Orlando finding their way. I think they have found their way in terms of the attack. And Martin Ojeda being that number 10 that we were kind of calling for him to be. Facu Torres, getting woken up by being left off of Uruguay's Copa America team. Like, those are the two most significant parts of it. Enrique's been good. Ivan Angulo has been pretty good. Getting Cartagena and Araujo back. I still don't think that Orlando City can win this tournament, but if they make it to the quarters or the semis, I'm not going to be at all shocked. And then if they spin that into a charge down the stretch where they win, you know, seven of their final nine games and end up in the playoffs in a, you know, on a streak where nobody's going to want to face them, that seems very plausible to me. The Montreal, like dominating Montreal the way they did, is just like part of that larger ecosystem. The rest of the mentions here, Daniel Rios has been excellent. Jossie Zardes, it's nice to see Jossie get one last trip in the spotlight, because I think that's probably what this is. But he's been really, really good for Austin over those four matches. Ty Baribo showing that maybe he should have gotten some minutes before Julian Carranza was sold. But I thought the man of the match day was either Steph Cleveland for his heroics in that Austin win or Denny Bawanga. Denny Bawanga was awesome for LAFC against Tijuana. And granted, it is the JCO Tijuana, so they were a mess in a lot of ways, rotated in places that they didn't need to be rotated and unprepared in ways that you know, the worst of JCO. He tinkers so much that while it makes sense on paper, it confuses the players and they end up being,
you know, uncertainty is your best bet as a defender against Denny Bouanga.
Exactly.
That's generally what you want in moments where he receives the ball, because Denny is, it takes him a long time to make a decision. I don't know if you noticed this. It's sort of like, it's like he's in slow-mo oftentimes. He's like, do I go to goal? Should I be direct, or should I just sort of, you know, meander about and waste? I mean, I saw the highlight. The one highlight I did see was the assist to Kike Olivera, where he just, I don't know how to describe it other than it was like someone in real time and against a team in slow-mo. It just looked like he was like skipping past people. It didn't look like two groups of players playing at the same speed.
It was not. I mean, it just so patently was not. And Tijuana set themselves up, JCO set Tijuana up to be destroyed by Bouanga and Olivera in the exact way that Bouanga and Olivera subsequently destroyed them. And to me, that takes nothing away from Bouanga. He was the best player I saw on the field in this first round of games. He was just like he was incredible. He really was.
Olivera, because we've been hoping, begging, wishing just for entertainment value's sake, at the very least, for that other side. If it's not going to be Bogush, and it wasn't for a long time, it was Olivera getting his chance, that he would come good. Did he come good in this game? Is this a sign of things to come, or is this a blip against, as you said, you know, the tinkering of JCO?
I think this is more evidence that he is coming good. Because he's a high level player, man. He was on that Uruguay Copa America squad, and he has been scoring and assisting more frequently for LAFC in his last dozen games or so. So I think it's a Gauss theorem kind of thing where he arrived around this time last year and he has his feet under him and he has more familiarity with both the league and his teammates, and his talent is showing, and this team is going to be scary the rest of the season. And I will, I'm not going to say surprised. I'll be a little surprised if this team doesn't win a trophy of some sort. I'm not sure which one, but I think this is a trophy-winning team this year.
Lewis O'Brien saw that, and he was like, you know what? I don't think I'll go back to D.C. I think I'll go to L.A. That might be more fun for me on loan from Nottingham Forest. You might remember O'Brien, of course, with D.C. United. It was for a hot second. There were issues with his ability to be on that Premier League roster, if I remember correctly, Doyle, but now he's back. Look, Steve Cherundolo straight up said, we need help in central midfield. That is what Lewis O'Brien is, and it feels to me like he's a fit for the way they want to play with those two central midfielders in front of whoever it is, Ilya or Atuesta, that plays D-mid. Not really, no tens, more like eights that have an ability to arrive late and every now and then are dangerous.
Yeah, and I do wonder if maybe O'Brien ends up getting some moments as a six even, because he did seem to have some of that to him in D.C. But either way, John Thorrington's done a pretty great job. He's done an excellent job of putting this roster together. They now have depth in spots where we thought they were a little bit thin. I think they could sign maybe one more center back, but it's not crucial at this point. And they have an open DP slot to play with as well.
Giroud is coming probably any day now. He might already be in LA. Who knows? I know end of the month of July, sort of beginning of August, is what they were shooting for to get everything settled. And hopefully in the knockout rounds, he could make his debut for LAFC. Is this Antoine Griezmann stuff real? Or is this just Instagram of Griezmann like being at the Olympics and liking posts and commenting? Because I saw he commented on the Giroud post that LAFC put up, and then they pinned it. So I'm trying to see through the smoke here. Is this real, or do you just want it to be real? Or could it be both?
I think we want it to be real. I think that Griezmann will eventually play in MLS. I think it's maybe even likely that he plays for LAFC. But I don't think that'll happen until next summer, because I think part of what LAFC want to be is a selling club. And that means developing and selling guys like Bogush and Kike Olivera.
I think we had a cat.
Yep.
Making noise. What are we playing with?
He found one of his toys that was still in the plastic wrapper, and this idiot cat loves nothing more than eating plastic wrappers. So, yeah.
To be fair, as you described that, and I tried to imagine, even myself picking up a nice crinkly new toy wrapped in cellophane, I just thought, you know what? You just have to rub that between your hands a few times. It's the preamble. That's the anticipation of a new toy, Doyle. All right, let's keep it going. Paul Rothrock. Could he be one of the best individual performances?
He was great, dude. And like the Sounders, they had a couple of goals. And it was, the first one was Jackson Reagan to Jordan Morris to Paul Rothrock. And the second one.
That's two-thirds of a soccer carpool right there, Doyle.
Yeah.
Reagan and Rothrock, which is honestly, that's got a real ring to it. Reagan and Rothrock. That sounds like a morning talk show. You know, next on, you know, Rothrock and Reagan. I'm sorry, I'm in a strange mood today.
And the next one was Leyva to Rothrock to Morris. All Academy guys, right? Like Jordan Morris was one of the first Academy guys for Seattle to come into the first team. And, you know, Leyva was highly touted, but never really broke through and won a job, but he's still only 20 years old, and he's getting more minutes and he's contributing in more real ways. And Rothrock and Reagan were guys who were sort of like just not good enough when they were in their early 20s, and both came into the first team with you know, performances via college and then via Tacoma for Reagan and for Rothrock as well. And it's just... It's nice to see a team build not just depth, but like match winning quality via these avenues. It's the version of MLS that we were hoping to see 10 years ago. And a few teams have gotten there sooner than the Sounders, but I'm not sure that anybody has done it better than the Sounders over the past five seasons.
I'm looking because I just needed to know 2024 Major League Soccer with the FBRAP, just the scouting report for Paul Rothrock, where he is percentile wise against attacking midfielders and wingers in Major League Soccer. What do you think his percentile is for non-penalty XG per match in percentile against his peers?
I would say he's above the 80th percentile.
78% for Paul Rothrock. He is 92nd percentile in progressive passes received.
Yeah, that's a big one. That's a big one, because that tells you that your winger, because he's always playing as a winger, that tells you that he's getting into spots that are dangerous. And I'm going to cross-reference it later. In fact, go ahead and do a filibuster on something, because I want to cross-reference this with American Soccer Analysis, their goals added metric. They have goals added by passes received. And if that number is high as well, that's telling you he's receiving a ton of progressive passes in high value spots that then lead to goals for players like Jordan Morris.
Stay tuned for this nerdery live on Extra Time as Matt Doyle catches me up on the League's Cup match day one. We do have a tweet here from DSC Smurf that says, Sounders will only go as far as Paul Rothrock will drag them. I also saw that Caleb Carr, you know, like in this long weekend of zero debauchery and just child wrangling in a foreign place, I saw the Meg that Paul Rothrock pulled off over there on that left sideline. I saw some people saying, I don't know if that was intentional. Gentlemen and ladies, let me tell you, that was 100% intentional. Paul Rothrock is an absolute, I don't know, a good example magician of why you should have a second team. And yeah, why you shouldn't give up on players when they are 18, 19, 20, 21. Yeah, that's one of the things that I think, you know, the super draft has proved a lot, many times over, is that development is not going to be at the same pace for every player, and every player won't have the same opportunities or be ready for them at the right moment. But my God, does a Paul Rothrock, a Seattle native, really bring something to this Sounders team, both on the field but also in the vibes, Doyle, also for the fans, just for love of the game, love of your team. Have you yet found this statistic?
His receiving is good. It's not elite.
He receives
a lot of progressive passes, but he's not receiving a ton of them in super valuable position. Like he's not Denny Bawanga in terms of receiving the ball.
Fair enough. I take back nothing that I said. Nothing at all. By the way, speaking of things that you need in Major League Soccer, a little bit of center back depth could help. Zach McGraw has been a very good player who was a backup to start the season. Now looks like probably a starter for Phil Neville. He double dunked Leon Doyle last night. Two headers, one late on to beat Club Leon for the Portland Timbers, which is a big win at home because now I believe they host the Colorado Rapids. They could win the group in match day two.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting to see the way Phil Neville used that back line by putting McGraw and Zuparic in as the center backs together. And that allowed him to use Kamal Miller and Eric Miller as fullbacks, but they were not super aggressive in their positioning. It was like a true back four where they weren't getting forward on the overlap.
I don't have a problem with him doing that. It seemed like when he started doing Kamal Miller on the left, that was when Portland started to just not be so leaky.
Yeah. Yep. And when you have a four-headed monster of an attack that's as good as Portland's, though Anthony started over Santi Moreno in this one, they're at their best when it's Evander pulling the strings as a 10, Moreno on the right, Cabecita on the left, and Felipe Mora up top. Like when you have those guys out there, you don't need a lot of overlapping from the fullbacks. What you need is sort of accurate early balls into the half spaces or even into the channels, because those four guys are so good together. They can, you know, if you give them a 4v5, I like their chances of creating something good. To do this on set pieces, which is not something that Portland have been all that great on over the past couple of years, it was really nice to see. This is a team that has been playing good ball over the past 3 months, and they get out of the group here. They maybe make a little noise that gives some confidence down the stretch into the playoffs.
Look, the nice thing is even if you start Miller and Miller, I guess if we're being specific there, you still bring on Juan Mosquera. You can still bring on Claudio Bravo as the game state dictates. And that's what they did. Santi Moreno, Claudio Bravo, Mosquera all came on. Deva Shala, who's been looking better and better, came on for Eric Williamson, who got a semi-rare start in this one, but has been starting to break into the team. Like there's something building there in Portland. I know David Goss was absolutely delighted that Mason Toy came on in the 82nd minute as well. How about this? Your boy, Willy Agata. Would he be your man of the match for Sporting Kansas City in a win against Chicago Fire, or would it be Stephen Afrifa? 20 goals and 20 starts at Children's Mercy for Willy Agata.
Yeah, flip a coin. Both guys were excellent, and I think that both guys are going to be with Sporting KC for the long haul. Willie's now got, I think, 21 goals in about 2,900 minutes across all competitions for Sporting KC, which is elite production from a number nine. He opens up space because of his speed and because I think the timing of his runs is just fantastic. And so that makes it easier for the guys around him, including Afrifa, who brings a lot of dynamism off the ball in a way that Sporting's other wingers didn't. Now, the grain of salt here is they were playing a very limited Chicago Fire team, one that was heavily rotated because they were missing players due to illness.
Nabu Katie said, yeah, illness on the broadcast. I didn't see anything on that. I do know Jordan Shaqiri is supposed to come back soon. I don't know if that is a good thing or not good thing for the Chicago Fire. We shall see. But, hey, Willy Agata is just proof to me that re-signing Alan Pulido for a long-term deal, even if he's not a senior DP, even if he can be bought down by TAM, just feels so unwise. And it feels like that, you know, that pivot point that I think Kansas City has fully gone to the rebuild side on, but they were still in that mindset where that sort of semi-mirage of last year Doyle convinced them that this can still be a championship-winning team and that Alan Pulido is a key to that team going there. And I get it. It's tantalizing. His talent, when he's healthy and motivated, those are important two qualifiers, is at the very highest level in terms of being able to both score and create for others. But man, the amount of time in the Venn diagram of like talent versus amount of time you get to see that talent actually exert itself, it's just so small. It feels like they should have just hit the reset button. But hey, a lot of decisions to make for Kansas City this summer and beyond. Last one here, nominated, Luis Peraza. I know Nick Cushing was super, you know, juiced about the backup goalkeeper, to go to your previous theme, getting it done in the PK shootout for New York City, but seemed like a disappointing result overall for him.
Yeah, I think it was. Peraza was good. I don't think he's going to take Matt Freeze's job. Matt Freeze is arguably goalkeeper of the year so far in MLS, but Peraza had himself a good game, and Cushing got more data on some of the guys further down the depth chart, the wingers like Talis Magno and Julian Fernandez, and you know, we got to see Moussa Bakrar up top again. NYCFC feel like they're a piece away, but they also feel like they can get out of this group and you know, maybe do some damage, win a game or two in the knockout rounds. And that's not bad, not a bad step forward for this team given what they were last year.
I think every coach is extremely focused, especially the good teams, but you know, like the teams that are fighting for basically respect as well. You need to get through the group because it simplifies your League's Cup month. Like, even if you lose in the knockout rounds, having that high level game, having that sort of competitive burn and going through your you know, your rhythm and your you know, your game day setup, I mean, it's all important just to get you through that time. The longer you have without those moments, the harder it is to get back to it when the playoff push comes. And yeah, that's important for every team. It's definitely important for Miami, Doyle, even though Leo Messi is not going to be risked until he's 100%, says Tata Martino. But Miami handled Puebla pretty easily, and David Martinez started. I need to know. I know it's Puebla. I know they didn't start Cavallini. How did Martinez look? Because he feels like a missing piece to me for the rest of the season.
I mean, he looked fine. There was nothing that jumped off the page in terms of how he played in this one, in part because it's Puebla. You know, it's not a particularly difficult test, especially at home. But the I think if Messi is the one, like, his return raises Miami's ceiling, Martinez is the one who raises their floor. Because in order for Miami to be the type of team that it is borderline impossible to be in the way that the Crew kind of have become, they need to be better with the ball playing out of the back. And Martinez represents that. He looked fine in his first game. I'm really looking forward to seeing how he develops over the course of this month and whether it means a second League's Cup trophy for Miami and a supporter shield and an MLS Cup. Because frankly, I think all of that is in play if he is the player that he was for River Plate.
How about St. Louis? I saw that win against Dallas, but you know, look, the scoreline there, I'm less interested in that than I am in how these new guys were. Hartle and then Toy Shirt?
Yep.
How is it? Toy Shirt? Yep.
Yeah. They both looked really good. Simon Betcher looked really good up top, yes, as well. They played a 4-2-3-1. And it was functional in a way that St. Louis hasn't always been functional, because they haven't put an emphasis on connecting passes, and they haven't had high level sort of like guys who can win the moments, you know, guys who can take a momentary advantage and turn it into a high level chance. And Teutscher and Hartle looked like they can probably be those guys to a degree. And Betcher, I really liked what I saw of Betcher in his year in Vancouver. And he looked really good in this one. He's never going to score 20 goals, you know, but he could score 12. And
he's definitely the guy that you surround with one, just more guys you expect to be productive goal scoring wise outside of the striker position. Cause he will make all the right runs. He'll be unselfish. The hold up play
occupy
will be good.
Center backs.
Yeah, and he'll just, you know, he'll get his 10 just by ending up in the right spot every couple of times, whether it's like a drawn PK like he had before. To me, that's a goal contribution. And he'll just find a way to be a part of, you know, putting pluses instead of minuses on the board.
Yeah. So I really liked what I saw from this team going forward. Defensively, I thought they were still they still have a lot of questions to answer. I think that they are, you know, they have a talent issue at the back that still hasn't been solved. I mean, it was Dallas playing without Ferreira or Velasco or Yarramendi, and they had long segments where they were kind of gashing St. Louis and you know, Berkey had to make a penalty save on Peter Musa in this one. So, it, you know, there's work to be done. But in terms of the attacking players that were added to this team this window, I think it was a really strong positive data point.
There is some reporting from Manuel Veth about a new Bundesliga, I think Nuremberg center back coming in, and actually left back. Take it back. He can play both, but he's mostly played left back. Yannis Horn. So, you know, another Bundesliga level player looking for another opportunity. St. Louis trying to improve on that back line. They had, I believe it was with Jaden Reed at left back. He got called for a penalty on a handball, but 22-year-old player probably looking for a little bit more experience there. And that left side, I mean, it looks like there's some real chemistry. If it's going to be this Horn guy, who I think knew Hartl and Leuven and Toyshirt from like German youth national team days, if that's your left side, that's not bad.
On paper, it works.
On paper, it works. All right, Matt Baker hit us up. I asked for some impressions. So this is your St. Louis POV on those debuts here. Much improved quality on both sides. He said the press looked much better with those two in their positions and Betcher and Thor in their natural positions. Exciting with flashes of brilliance. Also remembering Toyshirt was at about 70%, Hartl around 40% of what they'll ramp up to. So that's the St. Louis perspective for you. Those are positives. How about a negative, Doyle? I was scrolling on Twitter probably late night after my kids fell asleep. Dean Smith went nuclear on his team's performance, the game, the pitch in Philly, everything. They lost 1-0, Ty Buribo with the goal. He said, that wasn't an MLS game. That's possibly the worst game I've seen since I came over to the USA. It was a litany of errors for both teams. There's probably a big part of Philadelphia that's like, we kind of designed it to be that way for you. They deserve to win because they probably got the only shot on target all game. It was a bad, bad game. We have to take responsibility for that, and we told the players that in the locker room. And then he went on to talk about the pitch that he wasn't happy with, and he thinks there might have been a water shortage there and that he's played on parking lots better, which that's all in one quote. So Dean Smith was on a roll, and I respect it, Dean. How bad was it, though, for Charlotte? Like, was it this bad, or was it somewhere in between?
I think it was almost that bad. Yeah, I think part of that was Philadelphia kind of you know, they've maybe broken the spell, and they looked a lot more like the Philly teams that were so good from 2020 to 2023. And part of what those teams did was make games just be miserable to play against, make it hard to complete passes, make it hard to win second balls. And Charlotte weren't able to match Philly's physicality, I don't think. And if you're, you know, Charlotte doesn't have the luxury of not matching a team's physicality because they lack the skill to just take you apart. So I think it all just ended up being not particularly one-sided, but it felt like every aspect of the game, Philly won 55 to 45 or 60 to 40. And if that's the case, and you have a hot forward, then you're probably going to win that game, and that's the way it played out.
By the way, there's some reporting here from Tom Bogert, and we'll get to more of that in just a little bit. Charlotte are nearing a deal to sign Israeli youth international forward Idan Toklomati, and I'm going to, if they sign him, we'll really confirm that we get that right. But he's 19 years old. Clearly, Zoran Kroneta and Dean Smith are scouting the hell out of that Israeli Olympic team because Liel Abada is on that team, as is Toklomati. U22 initiative signing would be a fee in the ballpark of $3.5 million. So, hey, that would be an interesting move for this Charlotte team. I do wonder what it means as well for the future of, you know, of Karol Swiderski. But that is a question for another day, of which there are many in this transfer window. Speaking of, this is the transfer zone brought to you mostly by Tommy Scoops. Some news this morning not brought to you by Tommy Scoops. Andy Greeter had this one over at the Pioneer Press in the Twin Cities. Minnesota United announced on Saturday the signing of a 24-year-old striker, Kelvin Yeboah, to a 3.5-year DP contract through 2027 with a club option for 28. Genoa is getting paid $3.2 million in that range for Yeboah. And then there was another signing as well, Jefferson Diaz, I think a 23-year-old Colombian, I think from Deportivo Cali, also coming in. That profile seems more like it, but I said it before, man, this Kelvin... the Kelvin Yeboah profile here it's a little bit troublesome. I hope for Yeboah and for Minnesota United that MLS is the place, that Minnesota is the place that he needs to be to show his considerable talents, because he's got some, you know, double-digit goal scoring year on the books, but it's been a while since he's played more than like 700 minutes for any club team. Like, we're talking 4 or 5 years. So this seems like a little bit of a gamble, but hey, it's their money, their scouting, and their team. I don't know. There's not a question there, I guess. Do you think, what are the odds? Because I'm looking at their previous DP history, and we got the
previous DP history has been great. Like, I can't put that on Khalid Alamad and Eric Ramsey, right? Sure. That was completely different front office. What I'll say is that I don't think attack is necessarily where this team has needed the upgrade, right? I think the issue for Minnesota United is central midfield still, and the back line. And I would have used one of the open DP slots probably on a number six. Maybe they still will. They it doesn't seem like Yeboah is on a huge contract, so maybe they can bring him down off a DP hit. The other thing to bear in mind is that, like, Lucho Acosta costs $2.5 million, and Carlos Hill was 1.5, and I think Hani was 4. You know, Denny Bawanga was 5.
The Carlos Hill one just looks like
it's amazing.
Amazing. Robbery, it feels like, in retrospect.
So there have been a lot of good, great Hall of Fame level MLS players who have come in on something around what they're apparently paying for Yeboah. It's not, you know, I just hope that there are more moves coming. Because again, it's not the attack that's the problem for Minnesota. It's the central midfield. It's the central defense. They need to sort that out, and that's where I would be using my high leverage spots, especially because they essentially have a DP center forward, not just Timu Pukki, but like the way Taniolo Oshae has played, he's been fantastic, and like that having a non-DP in that spot who's so productive gives you the flexibility to go out and do other things to improve the roster.
It certainly feels like with 1 year left on his contract that, given this signing, given Oshae, maybe I'm reading the tea leaves wrong, that Teemu Pukki is like, yeah, it feels like a weird use of that particular roster spot. And like, he doesn't really fit the way that Eric Ramsey seems to want to play.
I mean, Pukki has 14 goals and 4 assists in 2,400 minutes across all competitions.
Oh, he's scored, right? Yeah.
So he's been, when he's been fit and on the field, he has generally played like a DP, but he has been rendered not irrelevant, but he's surplus goods given the way Tani has played, and that's fine. And the question now is, will Minnesota's front office and ownership group be able to open that slot up?
Yeah, like Jefferson Diaz probably feels like the more immediate, hey, this needs to hit for them than Kelvin Yeboah. And I just want to say, look, I hope Kelvin Yeboah succeeds. I hope the 11 goal season that he had in about 1500 minutes at Sturm Graz as a 21-year-old, like, that was who he really is, and he just needs a chance. I hope it all works out for Minnesota, and I also hope that this is that they can tam him. Like, I hope that it's not, you know, true senior DP level, though in the new age of 3+3 or 2+4+ GAM, like, it may not matter as much. So we'll see. We'll see, as with everything else. We'll also see about Cincinnati. Chidozie Awuzie-M officially signed, 27-year-old Nigerian center back. He has seen the world, Doyle, and he has also good friends, I believe, maybe even grew up in the same town as Obinna Nwodo. So he's got a good, some good scouting on what's going on with Cincinnati. This seems like the move they needed to make, the move they had to make, and it sounds like they did it within that Matt Miazga roster carve-out based on the season and the injury as well. So good work all around, it seems.
Yeah, and it also seems like it wasn't necessarily an injury, emergency type of move. Tom's reporting is that this guy had been on the radar for a long time. They've actually tried to move for him in the past, and only now do they have the flexibility. And maybe, I mean, not maybe, I'm sure there's some level of urgency added to it as well. But his resume is good. He's the right age. I think probably having a buddy on the team makes the fit easier culturally. And look, I want to see as many good teams as possible in MLS, and FC Cincinnati, when they have a functional back line, are one of the best teams in MLS. So I hope this works out because it makes the League's Cup more fun, and then it makes a stretch run in the playoffs more fun.
I hope this works out for the Red Bulls. Tom Bogert is reporting that they're finalizing a deal to sign Ivory Coast International, a midfielder, Jean-Philippe Gabamin. That's also Fabrizio Romano on that one. That would be as could be as a DP now, but a guy they can buy down. TBD, says Tom. This is a 28-year-old. He's a free agent right now, so it's a free transfer. And I believe he worked with Sandro Schwartz in Germany. So familiarity could be a good signing, especially if it's not locking up one of those DP spots. But again, I'll just repeat what I've said over and over. Please just go sign an impact player as well as a DP. Like, you can do both. That can be done. The Galaxy are trying to do it all. Reporting right now that from Corner of the Galaxy that Johnny Perez will be headed to Nashville on loan. That would open up a senior roster spot for the Galaxy and could make space for one Marco Royce.
I mean, Will Kuntz is putting together a masterclass of a 2024. If it wasn't for Chris Henderson, I'd say Will Kuntz is the executive of the year.
Looking forward to that one. Guillermo Arango, who I do not know, but this is an interesting tweet. Seems like he's a journalist in Colombia, says that Carlos Andrés Gómez, as we know him, is being followed by Ajax, Borussia Dortmund, and Bayer Leverkusen. They've asked about the player's contractual conditions in recent days. So we'll see him in action against Atlas here very, very soon, which we'll get to in just a bit. But, man, it does look like Andrés Gómez and his time in RSL could be limited. Everything I've heard from within the club is that they will do everything possible to hold on to this dude through the end of the season, given the season they're having and the opportunities in front of them. We'll see if a club actually steps up with a concrete offer at some point and tips RSL. But for now, I would expect to see Gómez in Clarion Cobalt through the end of the year. All right, before we get out of here, Doyle, let's look ahead. Match day two. What's the best group game you've got from all these? Again, I'll mention again, there's some big clubs coming in, like the big boys in Mexico, and then some of the biggest MLS clubs as well who have real designs on winning this thing.
Yeah, the big boys in Mexico. I want to see how Charlotte handle Cruz Azul, because it's a must-win game for Charlotte after that loss to Philly. Cruz Azul have been awesome to start the Apertura. They went out and they spent big, including on old friend Yorgos Yamakis, who's been fantastic for them to start the year. Cruz Azul are traditionally one of the giants of Mexican and therefore North American soccer. But over the past 25 years, they have been cursed. They have won stuff at a fraction of the rate of not just like Club America, but Toluca and Pumas and Pachuca and Santos Laguna and Monterrey and Tigres. And like historically, all of those teams I listed other than Pumas are like significantly smaller teams than Cruz Azul. Cruz Azul will want to start winning at the highest level again. And they want to win this tournament. And man, what a fantastic test it's going to be for this Charlotte team that's been one of the best defensive teams in MLS and that has a lot to play for in this game against a team as good, as talented as Cruz Azul.
Price of concrete's going up through the roof, baby. Yeah, Charlotte, after Dean Smith eviscerated them, have definitely something to prove in this game. I'm looking Cali Clasico, San Jose Galaxy. You got me all riled up about what San Jose showed in that first game. And look, fight can only get you so far. Sometimes you need results. And this would be an opportunity in a competition that's outside the misery of MLS, Doyle, to, you know, get one of those very valuable rivalry jabs in. Of like, hey, Galaxy, you're atop the West. Everything's going great for you, huh? Marco Royce, that sounds cool. Well, let's take you down a peg. And if the Galaxy, let's say they lose, and then it's Chivas on the other side, and then Chivas handle that one, and the Galaxy get knocked out early, how good would that feel for the Quakes in a season that has been, as I said, mostly misery? But really, I think because it's League's Cup, I always want the Liga MX MLS head-to-head matchup. I think we're all saying like Atlas is interesting, especially because Atlas got off to a good start against Houston.
It's a great win for Atlas.
Yeah, so it's a real sort of like decider match there that'll lead things into match day three. DC Santos is interesting because DC has the 2 points. Could they seal their place with a win here? It's at Audi
Santos. Field. Santos have not been good for a couple of years, really. But like to start the Apertura, they have not been good.
And then Monterey in Austin. Monterey has hub, but it's at Q2. So Austin got a little bit fortunate against Pumas. It's hard to get fortunate, it seems like, against Monterey. Or maybe that's just MLS's fate over the years, but that's a big one. Then all MLS matchups in Portland, Colorado at Providence Park is going to be really, really good. And then LAFC Vancouver should be a solid one as well. Before we go, you want to offer some thoughts on BJ Callahan, introduced as the new manager of Nashville, and they get started in match day two too.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see. He has roots with Philadelphia. He has roots with Greg Berhalter. Those are two diametrically opposed sort of game models. We know that Philadelphia is about you know, getting the ball into the channels at speed, winning second balls, controlling the game kind of by ramping up the tempo to the point where the whole thing almost breaks. Whereas the Berhalter model is pitch control over everything else. And I think when BJ Callahan took over the U.S. national team for 6 months, he was a pitch control guy, right? He kept Berhalter's game model. I'm not sure he's going to do that. I don't think he can do that with this Nashville team, which, you know, really lacks the type of midfield, central midfield ball progressors that you need to have if you're going to, you know, dictate the game with the ball and disorganize opponents with the ball. So I'm really excited to see what he can do with this team, whether he integrates some younger talent, which of course is something they almost never did, you know, under Gary Smith. Maybe bring in some South and Central American talent. I think they're the only team in MLS without a South American on the roster, which is insane. It just opens up potentially a whole new era for what this team can be. And I'm looking forward to that.
There was a really incredible quote from Jim Curtin on Callahan, and Curtin knows him very, very well. Said, I think Nashville made a perfect decision, a top leader, a top coach, whether you talk about tactical work ethic, speaking in front of the group, motivating athletes, whatever box you need to check, BJ Callahan checks all of them. Mike Jacobs, the CSO there in Nashville, talked about you know, guys like Shaq Moore and Walker Zimmerman and Tyler Adams, speaking about the moment when BJ Callahan had took over that USMNT group and what they thought he got out of the team. And that's what they're hoping to get now in Nashville. And of course, you know, because it's League's Cup, because these things are written in the stars, because unfortunately Ake Lobo has moved on, but still Nashville will open against Mazatlan. Mighty Mazatlan on Wednesday. So check out MLSsoccer.com and the MLS app for all the listings. Everything to come in League's Cup, Match Day 2 coming your way. We will be with you at the end of every match day. Basically, if there's a break in action, that's where Extra Time will drop in and catch you up. And Doyle, before we go, I have to say a very heartfelt thank you to you. You have adequately got me up to speed. I am ready to get back in the studio. My research today starts from a position of semi-expertise, thanks to the time you put in match day one. Appreciate you, man.
I'm here to make the stars look good. That's what it is, Weeby.
Oh, boy. That's what a way to end it. All right. Thank you to you two as well, Anders and producer Maria. You are also a part of this effort to get me somehow, some way back up to speed. League's Cup rolls on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Enjoy the action, everybody. We'll see you Friday. Adios. We'll be right back.